Good morning, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have two oral arguments on our calendar this morning on April 26, 2023. Just to go over a few of our procedural rules, each of you, and I think you probably know this, will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask you, when you come to the podium, which I might add, you can raise or lower if you want to. There's a special button on it, if it helps. But when you come to the podium, please introduce yourself and who you represent. We do make recordings of these arguments, and that way everyone will know who's talking and who you're representing when they listen to them. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Julie K. Seymour, and I represent the appellant, Beverly Kosak. To begin, I believe that there are some facts that are crucial to this appeal that I would like to mention. The parties were divorced by a stipulated judgment and decree in October of 2012, and at that time they had two minor children. The stipulated decree required the respondent to pay child support in the amount of $1,536 per month. That was reduced by the emancipation of a minor child to $1,060 per month, 9 months after the entry of the decree. The decree also required the respondent to pay spousal maintenance in the amount of $4,300 a month, plus 50% of his gross bonus, which at the time of the judgment and decree was averaged to be $1,667 a month. Respondent's monthly spousal maintenance obligation was increased to $4,769.60 per month due to cost of living adjustments. The decree did not specify either party's budget at the time of the divorce. Support and maintenance were paid directly by the respondent to the appellant. Nearly immediately, respondent commenced reducing his support obligation.
Before you move on, I have a question regarding the language of the decree, and I noticed you didn't make this argument, but there's a Karen waiver in the decree. Am I right?
No, I don't believe that there is a Karen waiver in the decree.
Okay, I believe, let me see if I can, do you have the decree in front of you? Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing, but if you have it in front of you, you could get to the bottom of it relatively quickly.
Yes, Your Honor. Well,
I'm thinking page 18. Is there a conclusion of law number 8 on that page?
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not have a copy of the decree before me.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to throw you off. My question was going to be, because on its face, Karen waivers are jurisdictional, do we have to address that in the first instance, even though you haven't made the argument?
If the judgment and decree does in fact contain a Karen waiver, I would certainly review the Karen waiver and see if it applies to amount and duration. And if it does, in fact, I would argue that the terms of respondent's maintenance obligation are not modifiable at all.
Okay. I didn't mean you were going to go on to discuss the kind of the facts of the case and what happened after the decree and what precipitated these motions. So go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Nearly immediately, respondent commenced reducing his support obligations by amounts that were not set forth in the decree for child-related expenses. While this issue is not a part of the appellant's appeal, respondent would disregard the expenses submitted by appellant to him for children-related expenses. Appellant did not submit any uninsured medical expenses, as it was her understanding each party was to pay what medical expenses for the children they incurred. In March of 2018, appellant hired me to address the issue of respondent not paying the entirety of his support obligation. In retaliation, respondent brought a motion to modify his spousal maintenance obligation by serving and filing a shell motion in July of 2020.
Counsel, I think we're familiar with the facts of this case, and if I could just dive into a couple of the questions
please.
I have. You raise in your brief a lot of questions about the effective tax rate that your client had in 2012.
Yes.
And I take it you're basically saying, look, because my effective tax rate was, what, 16%, I had, you know, more the after-tax money was, you know, I had access to than later.
Yes.
And the district court should have factored that in. Is my more or less getting your argument here?
Yes, Your Honor.
So my question is, did you make that specific argument about this 16% tax rate in 2012 to the district court? Because I didn't see that, but then you know the record better than I do, so help me with that if you would.
Actually, Your Honor, what I didn't do is I did not call out the specific 16%, which, as the exhibit demonstrates, was my client's average effective tax rate.
But are you talking about the exhibit that goes through how much your client paid in taxes?
Yes,
but
I am.
But you would have to put that exhibit then together with how much, you know, what the income was. I mean, there would be...
Precisely.
It's not like there was any one exhibit that made this clear, is my
correct.
Point.
Correct. So what was submitted as an exhibit was my client's Social Security Administration summary that demonstrates what her income was on an annual basis. Then, in addition, there was the exhibit that you speak of that demonstrates what my client paid each year in taxes, both state and federal. And
you wanted the district court to take those two together to figure out the difference in the tax rates.
Yes. And what I had asked the district court to do was not take into consideration the arbitrary number of the conservative number that Attorney Moberg presented during the hearing. During the hearing, Attorney Moberg it was a Zoom hearing, was using her calculator, coming up with numbers that were not part of the record prior to the hearing itself, and said, in fact, Your Honor, let's factor in a conservative 30% tax rate. And if you review the information that the district court actually had in front of it, which was my client's Social Security Administration summary, paycheck stubs that my client had submitted, and a summary of what my client had paid in state and federal taxes, the calculation would have been simple. And that simple calculation is, on average, my client's effective tax rate was 16%. Conservative, 30% was not conservative at all. That was an aggressive number to demonstrate what her effective tax rate was, certainly at the time of the divorce.
Sorry. And did you argue that it was not a conservative estimate to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor, I did.
And where was that? Because I saw references that, well, I don't have the exact amount of my taxes based on this income. It's, you know, as I say, you have to put a couple of charts together.
Correct. And I'm not sure that I use the language, the conservative 30% is not accurate, mm-hmm. but I argued to the district court that the actual tax information would be before it based on the exhibits that my client had submitted. And I think a bigger picture here is that in determining how to come to what the party's budget, or rather my client's budget, was at the time of the divorce, the court overlooked a major piece of income and monies that my client was receiving on a monthly basis by ignoring the child support.
Before we turn to child support, and just to maybe finish up, can you tell me what factual finding, and I'm sure I could see it in your brief, what factual finding is clearly, I assume you're saying there's a clearly erroneous factual finding by virtue of this taxation issue. Which factual finding is clearly erroneous because of that?
That's an excellent question. In fact, what the court did in its finding is not take into consideration any taxes for my client in determining what her need is for spousal maintenance.
So it's the gross income versus taxable income that you think is a problem in the factual findings?
Absolutely.
And where, and so, and that's in, when we get into mom's income, the findings that are on, like findings 13, et cetera, on?
Correct. Okay. So the findings are listed as far as what appellant's income is. And what the court does is makes an erroneous decision on what my client's monthly expenses are at the current time or at the time of the motion.
And do we know at the time of the dissolution whether that income that was considered was the after-tax or gross income?
The The amount that is set forth in the judgment and decree was gross income. So the $2,500 a month that was imputed to mom was gross income. The $4,300 a month in spousal maintenance was gross because
right,
at the time.
I think because we don't have expenses at the time of the dissolution, it's hard to know if that income number is before or after. Like if you included taxes as an expense and you still have a gap, that's why you set spousal maintenance what it was at the time of the dissolution. Because we don't know what the expenses were at the time of dissolution, we can't really compare to the list of expenses at the time of the motion to know if there was any difference or a change.
That is absolutely true, which is why we essentially at the time of the motion backed into what we believe the expenses were, and we're saying that the income that mom received, both in form of imputed income, spousal maintenance, and child support, plus, of course, the 50% of respondents' gross income, would help her make her monthly expenses.
I think there is a sequence, typically, right, between spousal maintenance and child support.
Yes.
And you usually include spousal maintenance as income for purposes of child support. I don't think it goes the other way.
No, you're
so
correct.
I'm not sure why the child support part of that is so important. We're looking at expenses and then and then looking at gross income, excluding child support. And your expenses exclude child-related expenses that would presumably be covered by child support. So, again, you're setting a standard of living in the marriage and comparing that as the baseline. So I don't really understand why we're focused on inclusion of child support payments or tax expenses when that doesn't really seem to be typically what we do when we look at spousal maintenance.
Well, at the time, Your Honor, the spousal maintenance statute required the receiver to pay taxes on the income that they received as spousal maintenance.
Right, and but that doesn't really factor into the determination of how much spousal maintenance to award. To determine spousal maintenance, how much you award, you don't look at whether it's taxed. You look at what the expenses were and the standard of living, is sort of a proxy for standard of living is spending.
Sure.
And you decide if there's a gap between gross income and expenses, and if there is, then you fill that gap with maintenance. So,
right.
Again, I'm not sure why the fact that maintenance payments are taxable, even though there may not be for this couple because it's grandfathered in, but the change in regarding the taxability of spousal maintenance doesn't seem to affect the decision on how much maintenance to award, because that's driven by monthly expenses, which we don't have at the time of the dissolution.
That is true, but that's exactly why we had to back into it. And we had to determine if mom is able to make her expenses from the income of imputed income, spousal maintenance, and what we believe should have been child support at all, as well. And we don't know whether or not she was able to without taking the tax effect, which is why it is so important to use the actual and correct tax effect versus the conservative 30% approach suggested by Attorney Moberg. I think what we're left
with... But let me ask you this. Are you conceding that there's been a significant change that would allow for some modification?
No.
The change in her income is not, her gross income change, that's not significant enough?
No. In fact, as my brief discusses, the fact that she lost at first roughly $400 per month in child support 9 months into the decree, and then the fact that in 2019 when she lost the entirety, which was $1,060, that's non-taxable income that she had to help meet her expenses.
What child-related expenses.
Right. Yes.
Now they're emancipated, so presumably that you don't have those expenses anymore. I guess I'm still not...
I think in practicality, I mean, you can say that they're child-related expenses, but even the district court recognized that at the time that the children emancipate, that doesn't mean that her mortgage goes down or that her car insurance goes down or different items such as that. Maybe there's less food to purchase.
Is there any authority that suggests child support payments are just sort of general payments, income that should be used for mortgage payments?
No, but there's...
I mean, isn't that the theory in the statute for child support, is that you have certain child-related expenses, and you try to figure out kind of where that might be based on income, and there's the algorithm tells you what you're owing, and when you look at maintenance payments, you're looking at non-child-related expenses.
I would agree with that, but I think that what the court has recognized is that child support is used for food and shelters and necessities, and all of those things don't just go away or reduce because the child support goes away. What my client did is she continued and increased her income in order to supplement what she was no longer receiving in child support.
If I can ask a question on a different topic, you raised in your briefs and I think in your reply some questions about the district court's decision to attribute investment income to cash reserves.
Yes, okay. Your Honor.
And I looked at that, but is this one of those situations where you go, well, no harm, no foul kind of thing? Because I'm looking at finding 21, where the court finds that mom's gross monthly income from her employment is now like that 50-20. When added to the 250 per month, the court finds that she should have been able to add an interest income. The court finds that mom's monthly income is and goes back to the 50-20. So, you know, is there some other place that comes into play, or is that just, well, if the court, I'm not saying, do we even have to reach whether that was a mistake, since it didn't seem to factor into the budget?
It did not seem to factor into the budget, but it does raise an interesting question, if I may continue. My time is up.
Yes, please answer the question.
What the interest income takes into consideration, or that investment, so to speak, is, and what is ignored, is due to the court retroactively applying the modified amount all the way back to July of 2020, which we believe is a reversible error. It did not consider that mom now is shorted an additional $780 per month by having to repay dad back 20% of the ongoing amount of $3,900. And so she is using her cash reserve. She is using the investments that the court allocated as investment income.
But didn't apply that allocation, right?
Not at all.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you. You'll have five additional. Do you have any questions?
Thank you.
Five additional minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, we turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joni Moberg, and I represent the respondent in this appeal, who is Kenneth Kosak. There are three issues raised on appeal, and I will take them in order. The first is the argument that the court or the district court abused its discretion by reducing spousal maintenance based on an error in the calculation of wife's budget. I think it's important to note that that was the issue appealed, because Ms. Seymour just answered Judge Bryant and stated that there was a dispute as to whether there was a substantial change of circumstances. That issue wasn't appealed and it wasn't briefed, so it's not before the court today. What's undisputed is husband still has the ability to pay, so any arguments about his income and excess income is not relevant. He has never put at issue the fact that he has the ongoing ability to pay spousal maintenance. Also undisputed is wife's income has more than doubled from the income that was imputed to her at the time of the party's stipulated judgment and decree. Judge Jessen, I also noted the math error that you noted. 5,020 plus 250 does not equal 5,020. We chose not to appeal that. It is an error, but it was a minor one, and we did not think it was worth the court's resources to dispute it. It actually makes it more fair for the court to affirm the district court's decision, because that error was in wife's favor.
Counsel, if I may, because you teed up the issue of appellant's budget, as directed by the district court. I struggle to figure out how the district court came to $8,900. So help me there. I mean, I understand that, you know, the appellant had said that she thought the budget should be, it was more than $10,000 a month. I think your client said $7,500 a month.
Correct.
Basic parameters. And other than just choosing a number in the middle, is there more to it than that? Because when I tried to do the math, and I think this is some of the math you did below as well, if you look at kind of the three pieces, kind of the income and kind of and assume you're taking as a basis what this assumption from 2012 and add the COLA to it, it comes up to what, 9,300 about?
Something
not
like that.
8,900. Well, so what do we do? Why don't we have to send this back and say, district court, show us your work?
I think that there's some confusion in translating from pre-tax and post-tax back and forth. And also there's confusion born from the fact that in the judgment and decree drafted by counsel, I was not one of them at the time, there was no budget given. So oftentimes we want to start, there was a determination of the marital standard of living. What was that and how can we compare that to what we have now? That was lacking, so that was troubling. But what the district court agreed with, and it was reasonable that the district court agreed, is that what we can conclude is the spousal maintenance and child support she was receiving at the time of the judgment and decree met her needs. I don't think from there we really need to go and say what was the exact net income she had at that time. We can simply rest and say the spousal maintenance and child support she received at that time met her needs. From there, the district court really had to determine what are her needs now. And Mr. Kosek had an argument that her net budget was $7,500 a month. Ms. Kosek said hers was something between 10 and 11. The district court looked at her actual detailed line-by-line budget and announced a few categories that the court thought were too high and said, this is what I think her budget is. That's within the court's discretion to do that. I'm not aware of any case law that says the court has to go through a budget line by line and say, this is what each item is, this is how much I'm taking off to withstand appeal. So the amount of the budget that the district court ultimately determined is reasonable and is supported by the record because the court said, these are categories of expenses that are this much and I think they're high, so I'm going to take some of that off, which it's my discretion to do, and this is what I determine her
so
budget is.
So your assumption is that the district court in coming up with the $8,900 was working from appellant's proposed 10,000 plus budget. And just discounting some of those.
I think it was two factors. I think that the court did kind of a gut check, for lack of a more sophisticated term, and said, how does this look compared to what was available to wife at the time of the divorce? But there is a finding where the court says she claims these budget, here are specific line items, and these are the amounts for each item that I think are too high. And so then a finding or two later, the district court says, so this is what I think her budget is.
But when I look at findings 24, I mean, I understand the district court says, I think these are too high, but he also says, mom seems to agree that it's appropriate to look at the resources provided to mom in the J&D as a measure of the mom's budget at the time. I mean, and then points out she also wants the child support included and all that, but it appeared to me reading this, and tell me if you just read it a different way, that the district court was saying, look, I'm going to try and kind of assume that her budget was that the J&D addressed her budgetary needs and worked from there, as opposed to, as you're now suggesting, taking her proposed $10,000 budget and working backwards.
I think you can do both. You can say, this is what she's claiming now. Do I think that's reasonable? And when I'm determining whether it's reasonable, I really need to compare it or at least look at it in the same context as what was reasonable for her at the time of the divorce. So, again, it's undisputed that her income has doubled. After the court has determined there's a substantial change of circumstances, it has to examine all the spousal maintenance factors, of which her budget is one. It basically balances husband's ability to pay against her need, and her need, again, because his ability to pay is not an issue, her need is how much does she have available to her from investment income and from her employment efforts minus her budget. And the court determined there was a need. That's why the court denied husband's motion. We just talked about the budget. In the end, there's a lot of numbers and the tax issues get really confusing. But in the end, if you look at she was receiving $4,769.60 of spousal maintenance after the COLA had taken effect for years. And her tier two or bonus share of the spousal maintenance was typically $1,667 a month. That adds up, Your Honors, to $6,436.60. We'll say $6,400 to be fair. What the court did is eliminated the bonus spousal maintenance and reduced the salary spousal maintenance slightly, and in the end, it ended up being just over a $2,500 reduction in the spousal maintenance that wife has received. So when we cut through all of the facts that can be a little confusing, at the end of the day, her income had actually gone up $2,520 when you factor in the investment income that the court missed when doing the calculations. Her income went up by more than $2,500, her taxable income, and the taxable spousal maintenance she received was reduced by almost the exact same amount. So if no one ever disputed that she had then enough spousal maintenance to meet her needs, and she did now, wife was coming to court and saying, I've never said that my spousal maintenance is deficient, I'm not here asking for an increase, the court said, okay, well, the income you had at the time of the divorce has now doubled. It's gone up by more than $2,500. At the end of the day, the district court reduced her spousal maintenance by that exact same amount. Taxable income went up. Taxable spousal maintenance went down by almost the same amount. On those clear facts, I don't know how we could find that this was an abuse of discretion.
Can you speak to, and this, I'm hesitant to ask because I'm sure I can figure this all out when I talk to my smarter colleagues after this, but the argument that when you look at gross income and whether it meets your needs, that there's a problem there because, I mean, the maintenance has to meet your needs, and that if you do it on a basis of gross income without taking into account that you don't actually have all that money to meet the needs, that there's a gap there that's not filled.
I think if you look at this case, the district court seems to be doing a post or a pre-tax budget, basically not saying after you pay taxes, this is how much you need, but to some extent saying this is the gross amount of money that you need to meet your expenses. That's not the way I normally see it done. But there's also case law that says district courts don't have to take into consideration the tax consequences of spousal maintenance. It's not reversible error when they don't. So even if your honors conclude that the district court should have done a more sophisticated look at tax consequences, it's not an error if the court didn't do that.
And that's, you don't have to take into account tax consequences of spousal maintenance. Do you have to take into account tax consequences of your otherwise your income, your gross income? In other words, should you be looking at net income to understand whether you can meet your needs? That's the question I guess I have.
Well, I'm not sure you need to get to that again because my argument was what the court did is say her taxable income has increased by this much and I'm going to decrease her taxable spousal maintenance by pretty much the exact same amount. So when you do that, you're dealing with apples and apples and as long as you're factoring in taxable income and reducing it by taxable income, you don't have to consider the tax consequences.
I see.
The second,
and does part of that go back to the way that it was addressed in the judgment and decree? Because the district court here seemed to be going back and looking at that, and those were, pre-tax determinations.
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Yep. Again, apples to apples is important when you're talking about pre-tax and post-tax, and that's what the court did. We knew you could meet your needs with this kind of taxable money, and so I'm going to consider what kind of taxable money you need now. The second issue, Your Honors, that was raised is whether spousal maintenance should have been modified retroactively to August of 2020 versus November of 2021 based on when the first hearing and the second hearing happened. The court was sympathetic to some extent to the fact that wife was going to have a retroactive payback, but the district court also did say, you knew that this litigation was pending, you knew what a possible result was, and you could have been planning accordingly. The technical arguments that counsel makes here simply fail. Just because the court didn't overtly reserve the issue of spousal maintenance when it came before the court on a motion to compel doesn't mean that it wasn't reserved. Yes, the court didn't overtly use the word grant, deny, or reserved, but it's not fair either to say that the court was silent on this issue. The court accepted the party's agreement that they were going to go to mediation on the issue of spousal maintenance. The court ruled on the issue of granting a motion to compel.
If I want to see the actual language of the attorneys when they're talking about their agreement, or I want to look at the actual language from the district court, is it just that transcript from December 20th?
That's correct.
Yeah, and I didn't see anything in there where there was an overt, as you put it, or express withdrawal of the motions either.
That's correct. And I think if you it's reserved by implication. If you're going to mediation to talk about it and you're not successful, you're going to come back here. Otherwise, the alternatives are pretty nonsensical. If the motion to compel, if spousal maintenance is no longer an issue, the motion to compel is moot. We wouldn't have spent time on that. If the spousal maintenance issue is denied, we wouldn't be going to mediation to talk about it. If silence in the decree means that it's denied, well, then we have an issue because there were competing motions. My client asked that spousal maintenance be terminated or reduced. The other party asked that my motion be denied. Neither one of those motions was expressly ruled upon. Does that mean they were both denied? That it's an impossibility. So that it simply can't be the case. Further, the Stillwagon case that the appellant cites here is not applicable. First, it was non-precedential. Second, it was an issue where custody and parenting time were both before the court, and when the court decided the substantive issue of custody, it was implied then that the parenting time issue was denied as well. The last issue that's before the court today is whether the district court erred by correcting a clerical error in the court and the conclusions of law in the judgment and decree. Rules allow the court to correct clerical errors in court orders at any time and at the court's own motion, so without any motion by a party at all. And that's what the court did here. And it can be an error that the court made or an error that the parties made. And here it appears to be an error that the parties made. Again, I wasn't an attorney on the case at the time of the divorce, but there's a finding that says what's supposed to happen, and there's simply no conclusion of law.
Was there any dispute about the worksheet that was attached that sort of was the worksheet that should have been attached to the decree but wasn't, and so now it's attached to an affidavit at the, you know, many years later? Was there any dispute that that was an incorrect worksheet or that was
not a dispute,
altered in some way?
Not a dispute that was argued at the lower level. But again, Your Honors, I would argue this is also a red herring. Whether that worksheet was the worksheet doesn't matter. The court had all of the information it needed in the judgment and decree to implement the findings of fact, which is these are their gross incomes. We've agreed to that. This is the parenting schedule. We've agreed to that. That's all you need to put into the child support calculator to spit out the numbers that the court needs to use. Now, the challenge we all have in the real world is that the court of appeal or the district court or the child support calculator online changes periodically as the laws have been updated. So if we put these numbers in there today, the guidelines have changed, it would give us a different number. But the date on this document shows that the input was put in on that date, and that's the number that came out. And so it was within the court's discretion to say, look, it's clearly an error. The law requires this to be addressed. Is it going to be reserved? Is there going to be a deviation? But whatever it's going to be, the document has to say, how are the parties dealing with insurance and uninsured medical expenses for children? So the fact that it's simply not mentioned in the document is an error, and it was reasonable for the court to correct it. The last issue that's been deferred to Your Honors is two motions to strike, and I'll largely let that speak for itself, but one document was never produced at the lower level, and the second issue is some speculation about what happened on the transcript. The transcript needs to speak for itself. I disagree with Ms. Seymour's recollection of what happened that day.
I think, and your time is up, unless...
May I ask?
Yes.
I wanted to circle back to the first question I asked on the Karen waiver. I'm assuming, do you have the copy of the decree?
I don't, Your Honor, and I'm with respect to Your Honor, I'm quite certain there's no Karen
waiver.
I was
going to say, I assume that the language in there that waives the right to modify is only relates to your client, respondent, and not...
Yes. If that's there, that would not be unusual. He wasn't receiving spousal maintenance, and that's a permanent order that wouldn't be modifiable. But between the court and mediators and Ms. Seymour and myself, we would not have gotten this far if there was any sort of a restriction on wife's maintenance obligation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you for the last word.
May it please the court. I will go ahead and jump right into the second issue, which is the retroactivity of the most recent order. So the district court ordered the modified spousal maintenance amount to be effective as of August 2020. However, there was clearly not any motions pending in August of 2020 through November of 2021. And
what does the statute specifically direct us to look at in terms of that retroactive date?
Thank you for asking that. The statute is 518A.39, subdivision 2F. And it is, it can be made retroactive only with respect to any period during which the petitioning party has pending a motion for modification, but only from the date of service of notice of the motion on the responding party and the public authority if the public authority were involved.
And you're not challenging the date of service or the fact of service. You're just saying that it was no longer pending because it didn't have that hearing date?
Well, originally, when we the motion to compel was brought, that was our position, that there was not a properly noticed motion under 303.03 of the Minnesota Rules of Practice, General Practice. The court indicated that, no, in fact, it was proper given the COVID protocol, which that was never argued by the respondent at the motion to compel, that there was COVID protocol that she was allegedly, that he was allegedly following. That was essentially something that the district court inserted, that respondent said, yes, in fact, we were following COVID protocol. Nonetheless, the March 2021 order, when it granted the motion to compel and sent the parties to mediation, did not specifically deny, did not specifically grant, and did not reserve the motion of the respondents to modify or terminate spousal maintenance at that point.
And you're not arguing that the attorneys withdrew any motion either?
No, that is not the argument. Under Stillwagon, which is cited in our brief, it is clear, as it follows Anderson v. Anderson, which is a published and authoritative case, that if there is silence, it is denied. There is also evidence in the record from the district court administration when Attorney Moberg reached out to district court administration to gain some assistance on
issue. Go back to that first basis that you're saying about if it's silent, it's denied.
Yes.
Many times in family law, as you know, you have a motion and then someone makes a motion to deny that motion. Sometimes you have a motion to deny the motion to deny the first motion. Yes. What do you do if they're silent? Because now you would be, that doesn't help us out, really, if you've got two competing motions and neither one is addressed.
They're effectively both denied, and both parties need to bring another motion in order to have a pending motion, which is exactly what Attorney Moberg did upon learning directly from the district court that there were no motions pending. On November 3rd of 2021, Attorney Moberg reached out to the district court to gain assistance, and I believe it was a scheduling issue, if memory serves me correctly. And the court administration said, well, there's no motions pending in this matter. So file a proper motion, and then the court will assist you with the scheduling or whatever the issue was. And so at that point, on November 29th, 2021, Attorney Moberg went ahead and filed the respondent's motion to modify and or terminate his spousal maintenance obligation. So even the district court did not believe that there was a motion pending between August of 2020 and November of 2021.
So I guess to preserve it, I mean, I don't know, did Anderson deal with a referral to mediation on the subject at issue?
Yeah, I'm not aware, Your Honor.
So at the time that the district court issued an order referring it to mediation was silent about the motions, I guess it would be your view then that the party would have, to preserve that, would have needed to ask for reconsideration or move for something like that to actually get the court to reserve it in order to preserve it. So they should have taken some action on that
precisely
order then. And it just seems like a lot of work when a request is for modification and the issue is sent to mediation. I appreciate that stuff happened with the district court administration later and asked for new motions, but it just seems like there would be a lot of motion practice around what sort of seems commonsensical, that if you're sending the issue to mediation, it might come back to you if it doesn't solve.
I'm not suggesting how Attorney Moberg does her job, but certainly a letter to the court asking for her motion to be reserved could have sufficed and address the issue at that time. I see that my time is up.
I do not think so.
Well, thank you, but thank you very much for the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you both for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days.
Thank you.
This is the last of our oral arguments.